From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, a 20-year-old California college student named Yasser Afifi took his car in for an oil change. There, mechanics found a strange device attached by magnet to the undercarriage, a device called an Orion Guardian ST-820. That's a GPS tracking device that had been placed there by the FBI as part of a terrorism investigation. Agents this week found themselves in the embarrassing position of demanding that Afifi return their super double secret gizmo. He did. But what about satellite tracking an American citizen's every movement? Is it legal? Do authorities need a warrant? At the moment, that depends on where you live. Aaron Kerr is a law professor at George Washington University, where he's been following this issue. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's start with the recent California circuit decision. What happened there?
That was a case in which the government wanted to monitor the location of a person who the government thought was involved in growing marijuana. And so the government installed a GPS device about the size of a bar of soap on the suspect's car in his driveway. The government used that information to show that he was, in fact, near where the marijuana was growing and to show his involvement in the crime.
Worked like a charm, in fact. But the defendant appealed on the grounds that the tracking by GPS constituted a warrantless search and a violation of the Fourth Amendment.
The court did not agree that it was an unconstitutional search, but Judge Alex Kaczynski, a particularly influential judge on that court, said that it should amount to a search because GPS surveillance is just so different from any other kind of outside surveillance we've seen before. And there's been a disagreement more broadly among federal judges and state judges as to how the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution should apply to this new kind of GPS surveillance.
For example, there was a decision by the District of Columbia that found unequivocally that GPS tracking does constitute a search and does require a warrant. How did that district look at a very similar set of facts and draw such a different conclusion?
The D.C. court came up with what's really a pretty novel theory of how to apply the Fourth Amendment. Their view was that you look not at whether a particular act by the government invades privacy, but rather whether a set of acts over a period of time invades privacy. So the D.C. Circuit Federal Court of Appeals said that installing a GPS device for a short period of time is not a search. But once it happens over a long period of time, in that case, 1 month, eventually you get to a point where the government gathers so much information that that invades someone's privacy. It's really the accumulation of evidence over time.
Yeah, you had a pretty hilarious line in your piece. You know, you were wondering what miraculous technology the government was able to determine when enough data had been collected as to render it a Fourth Amendment search. You said, what do they have, an aggregatometer?
Yes, this is the problem with saying that over time, eventually the line gets crossed is, okay, you're a police officer watching somebody. When's the line crossed? You need to know that in order to know how to follow the Constitution. And for that reason, the Supreme Court has emphasized that the rules need to be clear. The real question here is, does installing a GPS device amount to a highly invasive search akin to entering someone's home, or is it more like observing somebody in public? And that's the kind of issue that the courts have really divided on.
It seems to me that the analog that is most obvious is the difference between a GPS search and having a bunch of policemen in unmarked cars staking out a suspect and just following them all over creation. What makes a GPS search different than just an ordinary tail?
The idea is that GPS surveillance is so easy to conduct and is so detailed that it just is in a separate category. So in a pair of Supreme Court cases in the early 1980s, the Supreme Court said that beeper surveillance, in those cases it was installing a radio device that determined location, that in that case it was no search, it didn't trigger the Fourth Amendment, unless the government was obtaining information about where the device was inside a home. As long as the government wants to only monitor the location of a car on a public road, no search. But, the Supreme Court said, there may be circumstances where we're talking about a real dragnet where we might have a different result.
So I got to tell you, I am so at a loss to figure out the difference between GPS technology, which obviously is now ubiquitous, and a homing device, a beeper that doesn't operate by GPS but by radio waves and accomplishes approximately the same thing. How is that different?
Those who say there's a difference make this argument. They say, listen, a radio beeper requires a government officer to be following the car in real time whenever the beeper is being used. The location is only a radio signal that has to be intercepted by a police officer following the car. In contrast, if you put a GPS device on somebody's car, you could monitor them for a month, for 2 months, wherever the car goes. No need for an officer to be there. And as a result, the tool is just that much more dangerous because even though the information that is obtained is the same, there's just a greater risk of abuse.
You know, is it possible for Congress to step in and write a very clear statute to set simply a lower threshold of warrant for that kind of search as opposed to going into my house and rooting through my drawers, leaving it for the courts simply to rule whether it's constitutional or not? Is that a possibility?
It's absolutely a possibility. One big issue here, where is Congress? The way the Constitution works in the Fourth Amendment setting is that there's either a warrant protection or there's no protection. There's not a whole lot of middle ground. In contrast, the Congress can enact all sorts of middle grounds. And there's been some hearings about this question recently before the House Judiciary Committee. They can look at this and maybe require slightly lower threshold court order than a warrant. The courts don't really have that luxury.
Aaron, thank you so much.
Happy to join you.
Aaron Kerr is a law professor at George Washington University and a blogger at The Volokh Conspiracy.
Crime is rising, according to the British Center for Retail Research, and it's costing the UK economy almost £5 billion a year. Tony Morgan has one solution. He's the founder of Internet Eyes, which went live this week in the UK. It enables any resident of the European Union to catch crooks from the comfort of their couch. And if they do, they'll be rewarded in cash, up to £1,000, in fact. Internet Eyes sees itself as a kind of citizens' anti-crime brigade, but civil liberties campaigners see it as more evidence that Britain's Big Brother surveillance society is stronger than ever. Here's how it works. If you own a computer and subscribe to the service, you watch four simultaneous streams of closed-circuit footage from shops and businesses streamed live by Internet Eyes. If you see something suspicious, you hit an alert button on your keyboard. A text message is sent to the shopkeeper to alert them to the incident.
He can then check out the aisle where that camera is watching and just see what's going on. This will act as a deterrent, because if you steal, you're going to know that even if you distract the security guard or the shopkeeper's attention, somebody is still watching.
Are you worried about people flooding the system with false alerts?
No, because when the shopkeeper has dealt with the problem that he has, then he goes back to his screen and he clears it. It also asks him for 3 reward points if it was a crime, 1 reward point if it could have been a crime and he could see what the person was alerting him to. But then if there are no reward points, and that happens 5 times on the trot, then the person will get a caution and just asked to be more vigilant in their monitoring. And if they do it another 3 times without anybody being seen, caught, then they'll be struck off.
What's the Internet Eyes business model? I know you get subscriptions. Is this enough to support Internet Eyes? Are the businesses paying you as well?
Yes. After January the 4th, the stores that we have and other stores will pay £75 per month, which is, I suppose you could say, a nice bag of sweets, maybe £2.60 a day. So we feel it's very inexpensive, considering the amount of shoplifting.
Internet Eyes went live at 10 a.m. GMT on October 4th. How many subscribers have you got so far?
Well, we're looking to have 3,000 by the end of the month to monitor 120 cameras. That is our aim. We will reach that by probably the 20th, 21st of the month.
Now, your assumption is that people will pay for the privilege of being good citizens, or are you appealing to the voyeur in all of us, or both?
There's no voyeuristic pleasures out of Internet Eyes. If you want voyeuristic pleasures, you can go onto hundreds of webcams and you can stay on the same webcam all day long. You can go into Times Square and watch it all day. You can go into Piccadilly Circus, watch it all day.
These are available to the public?
Oh, yeah, hundreds of them. So if you want voyeuristic pleasures, go to those. Internet Eyes is just solely for reducing the amount of shoplifting that happens in our shops and hopefully to reduce prices.
And the subscribers can't pick which stores they're looking at, right? I mean, you can't simply sign up to look at Marks and Spencer's because your wife works there.
No, you can't demand any shop. It's all completely random. You won't be given any shops in your postcode area.
Internet Eyes has been accused of encouraging private citizens to engage in a kind of culture of snooping. There's a group called Big Brother Watch that called it a worrying development akin to pimping out closed-circuit TV images to amateur bounty hunters?
Well, everybody's entitled to their opinion, but there are a lot of people in this country who are frightened to say anything about crime. I mean, there are some strange characters about, and there are some elderly people. This particular lady that I'm thinking of is quite elderly, and she would no way dare to say anything to somebody that was shoplifting.
Well, I would assume you would say something to an employee in the shop and not confront the person directly.
If you did that and then the employee went over to the person, you'd be in trouble.
Because?
Well, I mean, the aggression in some people is awful. You wouldn't dare to go up to a security guard and say, excuse me, that gentleman over there has just pinched a bottle of whiskey. Because the security guard has to see him do it to be able to arrest him or have some evidence. And the person would know that you've told on him, and you would be the one in trouble.
Do you worry that some people might see this as a kind of reality spy game?
I'm sure some people will. You're entitled to your own opinion. All I can go by is the response I've had from all over the world. We've got hundreds of emails saying, at last, because people are fed up of people getting something for nothing all the time and everybody footing the bill.
Tony, thank you very much.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for your time.
Tony Morgan is the founder and managing director of Internet Eyes.
Coming up, a conversation with the man in charge of the BBC.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. 110 years ago, Ted Turner brought forth on this continent a new cable network, CNN, conceived of as a 24-hour news service dedicated to the proposition that all news all the time was a profitable strategy. But 3 decades later, can we hallow this ground as CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News engage in a three-way war over whether 24-hour news or partisan commentary is the only path to survival? Gabriel Sherman has investigated the personalities and the politics of cable news in the last decade, and he's written a piece called Cable Ugly for New York Magazine. Gabriel, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Most people don't watch cable news, so why should the casual news consumer care about the overheated cable news wars?
Combined, the cable networks get fewer viewers per night than just one of the network nightly newscasts. But these are national political conversations. This summer, the whole debate over the so-called Ground Zero mosque, that was really pushed on cable news. If you look at Shirley Sherrod's dismissal from the Agricultural Department, she was pushed out because the Obama White House was worried that she would end up as a subject on Glenn Beck's program. So you can really see that these are small programs that have a tremendous cultural impact.
At what point did it become clear that Fox News was a force to be reckoned with?
There's really two moments where Fox News established itself. The first is the Monica Lewinsky scandal during the Clinton years. Fox covered it around the clock nonstop. And then the second moment was after 9/11 and this whole patriotic upswell that followed the terrorist attacks. And since then, it's been a runaway success. And it wasn't until 2006, really, that MSNBC decided to embrace a partisan identity in primetime. And CNN still hasn't really responded in that they have really stayed the course. If you look at Lou Dobbs, who was one of the rare exceptions at CNN, he was pushed out because he didn't fit their model of traditional news.
Meanwhile, they seem to be hemorrhaging viewers. And yet, one of the most surprising observations in your piece is that CNN is quite profitable.
Well, the primetime programming only accounts for 10% of their revenues. CNN makes its money all different kinds of ways. They have websites, they sell their news to affiliates. So the primetime part of the business, even though it gets a lot of media attention, is not a big part of their revenue stream. But at the end of the day, what kind of programming you put on at night ultimately defines you as a network, and CNN has really struggled to explain themselves.
Which brings us to the question of flow. Who's got it and how do you make it?
Flow is having a discernible, consistent storyline that runs between your programming. With cable news programming, you have Keith Olbermann, who feeds into Rachel Maddow, who now feeds into Lawrence O'Donnell in the primetime lineup at MSNBC. At Fox News, you have Bill O'Reilly at 8 o'clock, Sean Hannity at 9 o'clock, Greta Van Susteren at 10 o'clock. So all of these programs have a flow that builds through the night that helps their audiences migrate from one program to the next.
It's the same thing again and again and again. This is the opposite of the model that CNN had.
What is the flow between Elliot Spitzer and Anderson Cooper? They're both smart media personalities, but you don't know what they're going to say on any given night. What executives at MSNBC and Fox News will say is you need to program to an audience who will come to you expecting to find a certain sensibility.
So in the midst of CNN's struggles, it brought in as a new president, Jonathan Klein, who was independent, formerly of CBS. What did he try to do to stake out an audience?
What's fascinating to note is what John originally tried to do in 2006 was to hire Keith Olbermann from MSNBC. And John's boss, Jim Walton, who's the president of CNN worldwide, nixed the deal because he felt that Keith Olbermann wouldn't fit at a nonpartisan news network like CNN. And so what John was left to do was to try to develop programming and court controversy and buzz in a nonpartisan way.
You know, it's kind of interesting. Anderson Cooper became well-known during Katrina for expressing the outrage of the people. Sanjay Gupta for taking into his hands injured children and trying to save them in Haiti. I mean, this is a way to generate emotion without partisanship.
That's been CNN's mission, is to try to appeal to the emotions of the audience through journalistic storytelling. When a big story breaks, that may work for a few days, but eventually the story moves on, and then they're left with the challenge, how do you appeal to the emotions of your viewers, who the easiest way to do that is through partisanship?
We appear to have one successful model right now for cable news.
What now works in cable news primetime is programming to a very specific audience night after night, and CNN, for the first years of its existence, really provided a news service that we all now get on the internet. And by dinner time, we've all been on our computers all day, and the service that CNN used to provide has largely been filled by news websites.
Let's end with something that MSNBC's Chris Matthews told you. He was talking about Walter Cronkite's famous sign-off, which seems to succinctly sum up the old style of TV journalism when the anchors spoke from perches high above the masses with seeming omniscience. Cronkite used to say,
"And that's the way it is."
What Chris Matthews told me was, Uncle Walter didn't know the way it was. He was an establishment liberal.
Gabriel, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Gabriel Sherman is a contributing editor to New York Magazine.
And now for a very different take on the news. The BBC. The British Broadcasting Corporation lives on what's known as a license fee. For the privilege of receiving a television feed in the United Kingdom, residents must pay £145, roughly $230, annually to the BEEB. And whether you watch TV on a television set or a phone or a computer, you owe, and failure to pay can earn you a fine or worse. Given the current economic climate, the BBC decided last month to put a freeze on the fee, effectively cutting the budget. The British press reported that some cultural programming, like expensive dramas, must be shelved, and BBC chief Mark Thompson warned that money may not be available to carry certain sporting events. Thompson stopped by when he was in the U.S. this week, and we asked him if that license fee can sustain the BBC into the future.
What's interesting is, I mean, two things. One, public support for the licence fee is stronger now than it was a generation ago. We have 97% of people using the BBC. And secondly, it turns out that the idea of a universal charge, which everyone pays and which delivers high-quality content, which everyone can then enjoy it free at the point of use, this is a model which actually seems surprisingly well-suited to the digital age.
It does indeed, although the notion of paying per television may not make any sense in the long run, especially if people cease to get their signals over the air, you know, via radio waves.
That's definitely something which might change over time. But the underlying point is not really about the device that's chosen to levy the charge. It's about the philosophical idea of an entire country, an entire community deciding to pool together money to pay for really high-quality content. And that idea, which I know is, in this country, in the United States, a very alien, strange idea. I mean, our countries took two very different paths in broadcasting back in the 1920s. But that idea still has remarkably resilient public support.
The second B in BBC is for broadcasting. It's not so simple anymore. What are you? What kind of beast is the BBC in a digital age?
Our critics would say we're a very big beast. That's the first thing to say. But let's not discount broadcasting. I mean, the hours of TV watched per week are going up in the UK, and I think they're going up in the US. In other words, there's no evidence that access to multiple other platforms and ways of getting media are actually reducing classic broadcasting consumption by the public. But it's true that the BBC, in common with other broadcasters, is finding lots of new ways of getting content in front of the public. Different kinds of content, I think, are moving into the future at different speeds. News already feels like a very multimedia experience. People want news from their BlackBerry, from their PC at work, still from the radio, still from the TV. Knowledge, culture, the arts is somewhere in the middle. There's some very interesting multimedia extensions, but radio and TV still really matters. And classic areas of entertainment, for example, TV drama and comedy, they still feel that they've got a strong future in the rather passive viewing experience.
I apologize in advance for the next questions, but nonetheless, I'm going to press forward. There's a delivery that BBC presenters seem to all share. I guess it's called the received. How is it phrased?
Well, people talked about received English or even Oxford English. I live in Oxford myself, denoting a certain sort of allegedly clear-cut, crystal-glass British English accent. If you listen to our services in the UK, by the way, you'd hear a great deal of regional variation. But I guess international listeners, particularly to the BBC World Service, expect a certain kind of tone from BBC presenters.
And kind of a sing-songy delivery of news broadcast, no?
I think that's a shade harsh, Bob. I mean, the main thing we try and achieve with our global English newscast actually is speaking slowly and clearly enough that people who don't have English as a first language can still understand what's been said.
Dude, they don't sound like you, though.
BBC News with Michael Poles. There have been two explosions at a prominent Sufi shrine in the Pakistani city of Karachi. At least seven people have been killed. The Pakistani president...
Isn't there a certain style that talent is trained to use or at least come to believe is the only way to present news?
You sure you haven't been watching old Laurence Olivier movies? If you listen to the BBC World Service today, it's pretty straightforward English. We don't send them to kind of the Royal Shakespeare Company to learn how to broadcast anymore.
I know this will make a lot of listeners say to themselves, physician, heal thyself, but I will go to my grave believing that the BBC as a whole has bought into a sort of European, left-leaning, kind of bleeding-heart political correctness, that it is not the dead center, objective broker of news that it claims to be. Am I insane?
Because we're not face-to-face, I can't make a diagnosis. But overall, I would say in the developing world, when we're criticized in a sense rather from the other direction. For example, in India, I was told that the BBC's, in quote, support for the war in Iraq in particular had damaged our reputation in India. I was told that by a number of Indian business people and politicians. Now, what we try and do in the BBC is, in covering international news, not to take an overtly, in quotes, Western perspective, but to allow every part of a particular dispute to be discussed and aired. There's no question that there are some Americans for whom that reads as or can feel like it's the kind of liberal or progressive approach. But I'd also say that impartiality and objectivity, I don't think this is a state of grace which you can kind of smugly sit there thinking you occupy. I think it's something we have to work on day in, day out. And when criticism is justified, you should take it seriously and learn from it.
I must say, there have been times that I've listened to The Beeb and I've gone, well, that sounds almost like this presenter is an apologist for a Palestinian point of view. And as a newsman, my eyebrows have gone up. I'm not a Zionist, but if I'm thinking that, I imagine that there's hardcore Zionists who are thinking that and much worse. How do you monitor your coverage on an ongoing basis to make sure that you're not infuriating large swaths of your audience in coverage in the Middle East?
The BBC is minutely observed by all the players in that conflict, as we are in the conflict in Kashmir, in Sri Lanka, and three or four other particularly vituperative conflicts around the world. But the answer is that we do everything we can to monitor exactly how we cover these stories, the language we use, the balance we use, recognizing that these are conflicts where attitudes are so polarized that many on either side, let's say, of the Israel-Palestine conflict, themselves have a very particular view about what fairness sounds like. But this is one of a handful of the topics where we get the most numbers of complaints. Though I want to be clear, we get very, very large numbers of complaints from both sides.
As you know, all coverage is a Rorschach test from people's own worldviews. So the fact that you're getting accused from both sides of a political question does not constitute actual neutrality.
No, but what I would say is, I mean, in the most straightforward way, the way we cover that conflict does attempt to try and reflect in our interviews, in our debates, and also in our news coverage, the perspectives of both sides of the conflict. For example, the story of Gaza over the last 18 months, 2 years, we take extreme care to make sure that the Israeli government, the Israeli Defense Force, the leadership of Fatah and the Palestinian Authority, the leadership of Hamas, all get a chance to contribute and tell their side of the story. This is not done literally with a stopwatch, but it's done with great care. There was an enormous fuss in the UK because we decided, I in the end decided, that we should not run a charity appeal after the minor war in Gaza because of the danger that running a charitable campaign could give some people the impression that we were emotionally biased on one side or other side of the conflict. We would rather take the opprobrium of not running the appeal than run the risk of damaging our reputation for impartiality in that part of the world.
I want to go back to the lead up to the Iraq war when the U.S. press was roundly criticized, including by this program, for being quiescent, for so cleaving to the cult of balance that it failed to see an abuse of power. I wonder where in its ordinary broadcasting the BBC comes down on this. Is it your role to be a completely arm's-length observer to the news, or when you see governments lying to you, are you supposed to intervene on behalf of the body politic?
We are supposed to scrutinize and hold up to debate, analysis, everything that happens, including what governments do. And the BBC's record in the run-up to the Iraq war was one of investigative journalism, which led ultimately the BBC into a head-to-head conflict, indeed a rather dramatic conflict between the BBC and the UK government because of the BBC's reporting. I believe that our track record in holding our government to account was a strong one, and to be honest, was in contrast to the generality of what I saw in US media. Now, there are some, I think, mitigating circumstances. I think that the atmosphere in the United States in the years following 9/11 meant it was a very, very tough climate in which to, in a sense, raise your hand and ask difficult questions. But our tradition is, even if it means editorial leaders in the BBC putting their heads on the line, we should stand true to our values as an independent news organization. There was a big conflict about one particular report the BBC did, claims that one of the key documents the UK government had produced to persuade the British public that it was right to go to war, that this document was defective in a number of different ways.
The sexed-up dossier.
That conflict led to the departure of my predecessor, the last editor-in-chief of the BBC, Greg Dyke. It led to the departure of the chairman of what was then our board of governors of the BBC. But in the end, to be honest, it's more important that the BBC continues to do strong investigative journalism to hold the government to account than it is that you preserve the careers of individual executives.
Now, Mark, you think I'm finished with you. I am not, because we asked our Twitter followers what they would ask you. And there seems to be a great interest in your iPlayer. And our Twitter followers, most of whom I presume are Americans, are interested in paying a BBC license fee in order to have access to BBC programming worldwide. Is that a doable thing?
We're always happy to have that kind of conversation. Yeah, the iPlayer is available in the UK, and it's an application on the web, but also on iPads and on mobile phones and so forth, where you can very easily catch up at any point on demand with any BBC TV or radio show from the previous 7 days. And it's been a massive, massive hit with audiences in the UK. And people have heard about it in this country and around the world. There are some issues around rights and technology to sort out, but we will launch an international version of the iPlayer with lots of BBC content in 2011.
Well, Mark, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
Mark Thompson is Director General of the BBC.
Coming up, can you copyright fashion? Here's a preview of Bob pondering the question in the next segment.
But the thing about fashion is that it's about fashion. It's about all designs looking, you know, approximately the same. Short hemlines. Paisley was big for a while.
Oh, not for a long while, Bob. Take off that tie, whatever you're doing.
This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from American Jewish World Service, pursuing global justice through grassroots change at ajws.org, the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org, and the Kauffman Foundation, working to advance innovations in education to expand human welfare. Learn more at kauffman.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When Chelsea Clinton got married late this summer, she wore a Vera Wang dress specially made for the occasion. It was just lovely, white with some very tasteful beading around the waist. If you want your own, you can buy a licensed copy at David's Bridal for about $1,200, but it doesn't go on sale until February 2011. Of course, you can get an unlicensed copy of the dress much sooner and much cheaper, too. Alan Schwartz, a designer who specializes in quick-to-market copies, announced the day after the Clinton wedding that his knockoff would be ready in time for the holidays. His dresses usually go for about $400. It's basically legal to copy a fashion in the United States. Designers are able to trademark their logos, like the Nike swoosh. That's why counterfeiting running shoes is illegal. But you can't copyright the actual design of a garment, which means that something like a wedding dress, unadorned with Nike swooshes or Louis Vuitton monograms, is rife for cheap, quick, and legal imitation. Legal for now, at least. A new bill called the Innovative Design Protection and Piracy Prevention Act would, for the first time, introduce copyright protection for U.S. fashion. But do we need that? Law professor Susan Scafidi helped draft the bill, and she says it differs from the laws protecting music and movies in significant ways.
One is the very short 3-year duration. The other is that it only protects things that are substantially identical to the original. So if you copyright a book, you also have rights to the movie. If you protect a fashion design via the new bill, all you have rights to are that design and anything that has no more than merely trivial changes. The reason why the standard is substantially identical and not absolutely line for line, stitch for stitch identical is that in the process of making cheaper copies, little cut corners creep in. So the idea is to capture something that won't have major loopholes in it, but will protect really just the exact design.
But the thing about fashion is that it's about fashion. It's about all designs looking, you know, approximately the same. Short hemlines. Paisley was big for a while.
Oh, not for a long while, Bob. Take off that tie, whatever you're doing.
Doesn't the nature of fashion itself make it difficult to determine what is theft and what is simply observing a trend?
Not really. I agree with you that trends are so important in fashion. But there's a whole lot of variation within those themes, just like there are trends in other areas. When Dan Brown wrote The Da Vinci Code, suddenly there's a whole table at Barnes & Noble full of books on the Knights Templar or Mary Magdalene. So there's a difference between a specific example of a trend, which could be protected, and a really general concept, which can never be protected.
I should say, to support your argument, that the Chelsea Clinton incident that I described was not an outlier. There's actually an entire industry of getting copycat designs to market as fast as possible. It's a big business.
The thing about copying fashion is that it's fine to be inspired by, for example, Chelsea Clinton's wedding dress. But if a law like the one that's proposed were in place, then we'd have not only six exact copies of Chelsea's wedding dress, we'd have every competitor having to add in a little bit of variation, which could give us, as consumers, more choice. So the whole idea of intellectual property law is to stimulate innovation, even while it's allowing generalized inspiration from other things that are out there.
Now, of course, you've just articulated two of the gigantic objections to the law. One, on the subject of innovation, is once you protect a marketplace, that actually historically discourages innovation. And the other thing is that you're talking about protecting consumers, but, you know, if copycats are allowed to run wild, prices are driven down, 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 which I would think at least nominally would be way better for consumers, no?
Well, no, I don't think so, actually, Bob. In Europe, there's been protection for a while, and in Paris, the capital of fashion, they've had protection for this stuff for over 100 years. And a lot of the major chains that have been so successful in disseminating something like knockoffs, but not quite, things that are inspired by the runway, are European chains. H&M, Zara, Topshop. All of these folks live under a legal regime that doesn't allow exact copies, and yet they're able to bring cutting-edge fashion to the budget consumer. All of these big European chains and some American companies like Target have been partnering with designers to create budget knockoffs. How much more incentive will those companies have to partner with designers if a law like this were passed?
Now, there's another way to attack the premise of the legislation that you're supporting, that the ecosystem for fashion is doing actually very nicely, and that to the extent that people knock off Paris runway designs very, very quickly, that the trends move more quickly and therefore constantly churning everybody's closet so that they are constantly in need of new fashions. That while individual designers may be harmed in the short run, the overall ecosystem actually builds their business over time.
I would disagree with you on that, predictably. From 30,000 feet up, the ecosystem of fashion looks pretty good. The stores are filled with clothes, people are dressing fashionably. However, if you come down to the level of walking the streets and talking to designers, you'll see currently a lot of boarded-up boutiques and designers who are really struggling. If those people are driven out of business, in part because of the tough economy, and in part because they can't get return on investment because the copies get in the stores even more quickly than the original because of the changes wrought by the internet, then they can't stay in business, they can't keep creating. Over the long run, the ecosystem really breaks down.
I guess we should make clear how the internet has become a part of all of this. Chelsea Clinton is photographed in her Vera Wang gown. It immediately is downloaded, and before long, there are factories in China that are churning out that design for Alan Schwartz by the tens of thousands.
Once upon a time, 50 years ago, to copy a design, you had to sneak into a show in Paris, memorize the design, sketch it, send it across the ocean to New York, have it manufactured. It took a few months for that design to get in stores. Today, you're absolutely right. Whether it's Chelsea Clinton in her gown or an actress at the Academy Awards, those photographs appear instantaneously on the internet. Patterns are made the next day. Clothes are cut and sewn in the next week. Within a few weeks, those things are in stores, whereas the legitimate designs don't make it onto the sales floor for months because of buying schedules. This law would protect, in particular, the small designers, the designers whose logos are not yet recognizable, right? As you pointed out, some of the big companies can slap their well-known initials on the outside of most clothing and certainly many, many accessories, but for little designers, they can't do that. what's being stolen is not their names, it's their designs. And currently they have no way to stop that.
All right, I have one final question for you, Susan.
All right.
Who are you wearing?
Well, you usually have to call a 900 number for that kind of information. However,
I didn't say what are you wearing.
Right now, I'm actually wearing a couple of different emerging designers, one of whom is Emmett McCarthy from season 2 of Project Runway. My handbag is a young designer whose label is called Ananas. So I'm definitely flying the flag for those out there struggling.
Well, I would say you look lovely, but we are at the moment in different cities, so let me just thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Susan Scafidi is a professor of law at Fordham Law School and academic director of the Fashion Law Institute.
Hey, Chip, let's go. We'll be late for the game.
I can't. I have to put all of my dolls away.
Why?
Cindy's coming over for the first time, and none of these dolls have hats on.
Well, why don't you go down to Tiny Hats?
They're not open on Sundays.
They are now.
Tiny Hats is now open Saturdays and Sundays, so you don't have to worry about those last-minute tiny hat emergencies. Hats for small men and babies. Hats to complement cakes and pies. Wear one under your normal-sized hat. It's your secret.
That clip is from a 2007 episode of a comedy show called Tim and Eric. Awesome show, great job. The sketch is a fake ad for a store that only sells tiny, tiny hats. A few weeks ago, Saturday Night Live aired a similar sketch that showed young fashionistas one-upping each other with ever tinier, tiny hats.
Trish, look at Sylvia. I guess you're not the only one with an adorable little hat anymore.
Oh, how nice, Sylvia.
Thank you, Trish.
I tip my hat to you.
A smaller hat?
It's a smaller hat.
Trish!
Advantage, Trish.
Tim Heidecker, who co-wrote the first sketch, observed via Twitter the similarities between his haberdashery humor and SNL's. Bloggers and comedy geeks took sides, the press picked up the story, and Heidecker, half jokingly, half not, asked for a public apology from SNL. You might wonder, why didn't Heidecker just copyright his joke? The answer is that comedians can't. Legally, you can own the delivery of a joke, but you can't patent its premise. Heidecker owns his tiny hat sketch, but the general idea that tiny hats are funny? That belongs to all of us. Earlier this year, we spoke to law professors Chris Sprigman and Dotan Aliar, who did a study of how, in the absence of legal protection, comedians protect their jokes. They say there's a kind of informal policing that goes on.
The major sanction is reputational, so in that business, reputation is everything. And if you have bad reputation, agents are not going to want to represent you. Club owners might not want to have you in their club. People are not going to be willing to work with you on a comedy bill, like 8 or 10 comedians would work every night. And if you can't find other people who are willing to share the stage with you, you're pretty much going to be out of work. And then the last enforcement mechanism is physical violence or threats of physical violence.
Can you give me an example where physical violence was used on a repeat offender?
George Lopez, who's a pretty famous comedian, bragged a bit about how he'd jacked Carlos Mencia up against a wall and roughed him up after Mencia, at least in Lopez's view, took a whole bunch of Lopez's material and used it in one of Mencia's specials, I think for HBO. Generally, these disputes are settled. They don't come to blows like this. But if joke stealing is persistent and the joke stealer is recalcitrant, then you might eventually see something like this happen.
So what's going to stop Carlos Mencia in the end?
Well, the norm system, I think, has a weakness, which is it's difficult to enforce against someone who's truly both successful and a bit of a sociopath, right? So I'm not saying that that's what Mencia is, but if he is, if he doesn't really care about what other people think of him, then he's hard to discipline. But of course, you know, the norm system has to be compared with the formal copyright law, which is difficult to enforce too, because it's so expensive to bring a lawsuit in federal court that often it's just not worth it, right? So both systems have their flaws. The norm system flaws are not, obviously, at least to us, worse than the legal system's flaws.
Well, let's talk about the legal system's flaws. One of the arguments people make for formal and thorough copyright protection is that it encourages people to innovate because they can own their intellectual work. So does the lack of formal copyright protection stop people from innovating?
The reason why we started this research is with that question. How come so many comedians are creating without any effective legal protection? The interesting thing we saw here that A, the norm system substitutes and supplements the law and can act as an effective incentive mechanism. But also another interesting thing is that we noticed some connection between the form of protection and then the character of the creative art. Those social norms that we've just described to you, they did not always exist. The norm in the business was that you could steal. And before the emergence of norms, jokes were like text that anyone could read, right? When the norms emerged in the 50s and 60s with comedians like Lenny Bruce, you cannot just take a joke from another person and tell it as yours, right? Comedians have character, and some narratives are tailored to their persona.
For instance, Sarah Silverman has a certain kind of outrageous joke.
Right, so Sarah Silverman's a great example of what we're talking about.
Guess what, Martin Luther King? I had a dream too. I had a dream that I was in my living room, and I walked through to the backyard, and there's a pool, and as I'm diving in, there's a shark coming up from the water with braces. So maybe you're not so special. Martin Loser King. Yeah.
It makes sense only from within the persona that Sarah Silverman has constructed, this intelligent but completely obtuse monster, right, that she is on stage.
Mm-hmm.
For someone to take that joke and have it make sense, they have to, in a sense, do the work to reconstruct enough of her persona that it makes sense. And to boot, if somebody takes that joke, it's much more readily identifiable as Sarah Silverman's, right? It comes in essentially marked with her persona,
mm-hmm.
which helps the norm system enforce her property rights.
And if you contrast that with, say, a Henny Youngman joke, any number of Borscht Belt comedians could say it.
Yeah, exactly. So here's a Henny Youngman joke.
A lot of people say, how do you stay married for 41 years? Here's the secret. My wife and I go to a romantic restaurant twice a week. A little candlelight, a little wine. She goes Tuesdays, I go Fridays.
You could tell it no matter who you were. It doesn't have much to do with Henny Youngman's persona.
There are accounts of Milton Berle going uptown in Manhattan to comedy clubs, sitting in the front row with a pen and paper. He would also joke publicly about his practice. When his turn would come up in a comedy club, he would start his bit by saying, the last guy was so funny, I laughed so hard, I almost dropped my pad and pencil.
In the post-vaudeville period, and there's nothing wrong with that. Those were the norms.
It seems to me that there isn't a structure of social norms working on the inventors of recipes. They just go ahead as comedians did in the vaudeville days.
Again, the leading norm is that it's not okay to exactly copy a fellow top French chef recipe and serve it in your restaurant. However, those who play by the rules get cooperation and sharing of ideas and cooking techniques, and those who do not play by the rules are being kept out of the inner circle.
So what lesson are we to draw from the evolution of social norms for stand-up comics in place of formal copyright protection? That it's always better not to have copyright protection?
We have charted three different possibilities, right? The old Borscht Belt model, where you have comedians telling kind of jokes on stage with a rim shot at the end. Or we have the current stand-up world, where you have people standing on stage with personal, point-of-view-driven narratives. Or we can have a potential future where there's strong legal protections, corporations sweep in because of economies of scale in enforcement and clearing rights, and then humor is being cleansed, turning away from the cutting edge and becoming more family-friendly. And whether you want or you do not want legal protection depends on what world do you prefer to live in.
What world do you guys prefer to live in?
Well, it's a matter of taste, but the world that we live in now is pretty attractive to me. Comedians have enough of an incentive to create that we get a really robust market. It's very free. It's very diverse. There are a lot of different voices, and it's funny.
Thank you so much.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Chris Sprigman and Dotan Aliar, intellectual property law professors at the University of Virginia Law School.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Nerida Brownlee and Bonnie Watt, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Robert Granis.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs and our capo di tutti capi. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And John Solomon, we're thinking of you. We love you.
This is for you, John. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.